Okay, everybody who's been on hold and those of you who are still calling, we're going to go to more phone calls with Philip Carlo next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're going to go right to calls with Philip Carlo. I know those of you who have been waiting for a long time. We'll go to our wild card line. First of all, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Are you there? Well, there's... Yeah, go ahead. I almost hung up on you. Go ahead, please.
Oh, it's not Brian. It's Jacob.
Well, I never mentioned a name.
Oh, sorry. Well, actually, I was just going to ask him about... how, you know, about serial killers in general and the FBI profiling program.
Okay, he's with you. Go ahead.
And, well, it's just, you know, I mean, I just have never really believed in that because people are so complicated and you can't really ever truly know a person. And it's just like, I mean, and the really smart ones are obviously getting away with it for a long time. I mean, look at BTK. I mean, if he hadn't mailed...
Yep.
I mean, we would have never heard from him again. Look at the Texarkana guy.
All right.
Yeah.
If I may, I tend to agree with you. I tend to think that it's an oversimplification of what's really going on. They have had some successes, but they've had miserable, miserable failures.
Oh yeah.
The Green River Killer is another example. The BTK Killer is another example. Sometimes there are certain signs where it's the 2 and 2 is 4. That adds up to what they're suggesting. I don't think it should be discarded completely. I just think it should be taken with a grain of salt. It's
exactly.
Not the gospel. It's not like we see in movies or television shows. That's an outright fabrication. But the bottom line to what you said was, we are far more complicated than the simplifications they make and try to sell that as the gospel. It ain't the gospel.
Yeah, like the people like Andre Ciccatillo, too.
That was a great example.
Yeah.
For your listeners' benefit, Andre Ciccatillo killed over 50 people. He was a Russian. He took children into forests, mutilated them horribly, and they finally caught him, but they had no idea who they were looking for. The FBI went there. They tried to help. They weren't able to help. Ultimately, he got caught because he got himself caught. He just the lust that he had got such a feverish pitch that he stopped being careful. And what's interesting about this case is that like an hour after he was convicted, they shot him to death. There was a bullet in the head, and it was over. And a lot of people think that that's what should happen to those individuals. No,
done.
No appeal process, no nothing. Boink, it's over.
Did you ever look into Ed Gein, that situation?
Yes, very, very fascinating case. Alfred Hitchcock molded his wonderful film Psycho on that.
It
was a Hollywood version of what Gein did. So again, for your listeners' benefit, Ed Gein was a serial killer, and his first victim was his mother. And he took her in the barn, and he basically he cut her up, and he was wearing her breasts. They used a bit of that in Silence of the Lambs, and he went on to have 7 victims all told. A woman that worked in the bar, a local woman, and he mutilated them all and cut them up, and he took their breastplates, for want of a better way to put it, and he'd strut around in that. Very, very sick individual.
That was that scene then in Silence of the Lambs, that guy with skin on him doing his thing.
Yeah, he was trying to sew, he's looking for a woman, a big woman, so he could make a torso, or rather corset. Of a woman's real skin with the breasts still attached. And again,
what about that?
As far as such and as nutty as that sounds, it really happened. Ed Gein did it.
Yeah.
And there are people out there right now. I'm sure there's some people listening right now who are like, ha, 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 if you only knew. Well, guess what? We do know. And guess what? We know you're out there. And guess what? You're not as smart as you think you are. And guess what else? If you continue to do what you're doing, it's just a matter of time before you get caught. And guess what? You're going to continue doing what you're doing because you can't stop.
How about that wacko in Canada, the pig farmer who fed people body parts to pigs?
Well, what's What's so interesting about that case is how long he was able to do it and get away with it, and how after a while it didn't mean anything to him. He wasn't viewing them as human beings. He was viewing them as just garbage, and it was a good way to get rid of them. Pigs will eat anything. By the way, I think that's been happening for a very, very long time, people getting rid of bodies via feeding them to pigs. In Hannibal, in Silence of the Lambs, the follow-up, they had this whole esoteric mating of different pigs to have, like, this horrible carnivorous pig. But I think that's really part of our history, that people who did commit terrible crimes got rid of the victims by feeding them to pigs. This whole thing with vampires and werewolves, what that really was about, George, is about people, human beings, doing such horrible, horrendous things to other humans that when they found the bodies, they couldn't imagine. They couldn't wrap their mind around it. A human being did that. So they made up this mystique, this animal-like, half-man, half-animal creature that tore out the throat, that opened the skin, that removed the genitals. And surely a human being didn't do that. But guess what? A human being did do that.
First time caller line, your turn. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
George, am I on?
You sure?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I am so pleased to and tickled that you have someone, Philip, that is bringing this to light, because I'm a psychiatric nurse and I specialize in children from 2 to 10.
Right.
And on the unit, we'll have 14 children. It's supposedly a behavioral modification unit.
Right.
Out of the 14, we will have at least 2 children at any given time that has traits of being a sociopath. And as you had mentioned before, one of the main characteristics is they're so charming.
Even if you say again?
One of the main characteristics is that they're so charming.
Right, right.
And, you know, I mean, they're killing animals, they're setting houses on fire. And I agree with you that there's a whole lot of them out there. And I've been trying to tell people for the past 10 years about this situation. And with the mothers taking the drugs and all drugs. And, you know, there's so much of that going on now that we're having a lot of children that are being born with brain defects. And this is part of it, I believe.
I'm so pleased you called, and I'm so pleased you're adding to our conversation what you're saying, because the truth of the matter is it all comes from that. Adults don't suddenly become killers. It starts in those years, the formative years. The building blocks are put in place then, and it grows and grows and grows like some deformed animal, and then ultimately they turn on whatever's next to them, and unfortunately it is us that happens to be next to them. They strike out to whatever's close to them, and it's us that are close to them. And it's a shame that you, as a professional, you're seeing it, you're understanding what you're seeing, and yet there's still no help. And that's what George and I have been basically talking about all night long, how these individuals do fall through the cracks in the early years, how a fellow like Richard the Iceman Kuklinski wasn't identified for what he'd become. But all you had to do was look at him, and you would have seen it. He had all the trademarks. Wasn't identified, ended up killing over 200 people. And again, I have to hark back to, I think there are people out there listening right now, George, who are killers.
Oh, sure, and there's
no doubt about it. I wouldn't mind, if you wouldn't mind, one of them calling up, and maybe we can get into a little dialogue with a serial killer that's absolutely free.
I almost had the Zodiac killer call us once.
That would be interesting.
You know, they think he's still alive, maybe, and we did get a weird, peculiar phone call.
Well, if anyone is inclined, I'd be happy to talk to them for your listeners' benefit, and maybe we can find out some truths that we don't know. Maybe we can shine some light in dark places. Meanwhile, I want to thank this lovely lady for calling.
East of the Rockies, you're on with Philip Carlo on Coast to Coast.
Hi. I'm calling regarding Kuklinski, and, you know, I was haunted by those HBO specials
right.
I watched. I still think about them. But One thing, probably the worst, the most horrifying aspect of it, I thought, was that he would experiment with ways to kill people that he would use in his contract business.
Right.
Just with random people walking down the street.
Right.
I think off the top of my head of the instance where he shot a guy in the face with a crossbow.
Right.
From the behind the steering wheel of his car.
Right.
Called him over.
Mm-hmm. For directions.
Second of all, and I'd like for you to comment on this.
Please.
He seemed, when he talk about this kind of thing, he had this wry smile.
Right.
And almost, and I don't know if he was taking delight, you know, reveling in recalling what he did, or if he was proud of his profession, mm-hmm. of how professional he was in what he did, or what that smile was all about.
It's a very interesting observation. Basically, he was bemused by the fact that he was able to talk about what he did in an honest way and for it to be appreciated for what he did in an honest way. In other words, the HBO producers, her name was Gabby Monet, she didn't judge him, she didn't point a finger at him, she just sat there and let him talk, and talk he did. And you see, George, the effect that Richard talking had on mm-hmm. your listener. This guy, I no doubt this individual, this gentleman, is having nightmares because of Richard. I'm wondering, did you read my book, The Iceman?
No, I have not. I wasn't even aware of it.
Not to say that I'm trying to sell the book, but I was able to mine Richard in a much deeper fashion. I ended up spending over 240 hours with Richard, and I began with his grandparents and moved forward, and I was, the book pretty much ends the day he dies. I'd like to say, towards the end, very end of my interviews, I said to him, "Are there any regrets? Do you have any regrets, Richard, in your life? What do you regret?" And what he said to me was this, and I think it's very telling. He said, "I regret not killing my father."
You know what? That's the one question I was going to ask you close to the end, Philip.
Yes.
And I'm glad you brought it up. At this point, he never killed the guy he hated more than anything.
And he never forgave him either. And he had, that's the one regret he had in life. And again, he wasn't orphaned. This is an example, no excuse. He never did that with me. I never saw him do that. He didn't care what people thought. But he did feel that amazing, extreme hatred for his father. Because of what his father did to him.
I think he killed his father with everybody else he killed.
I think in a sense that might be it, George. I think you hit it right on the head. Anybody that took on a father figure, or even the connotation of a father figure, was fair game. The caller made talked about an incident where, and it is troubling. He just called over a John Q. Citizen, asked him for direction. The guy's trying to give him directions, and Richard was testing a weapon.
A crossbow. He fires a crossbow.
Man, right in the forehead. The guy went down dead. And
then he leaves, and he drove away, right?
He drove away, and that's what troubles people the most about Richard Kuklinski, the randomness of the killings upon innocent people. Everyone seems to be able to accept the fact that he killed killers, that he killed mob guys. But when it comes to the citizens, it's disconcerting. It's frightening. It's scary. It's horrible. And it is. And it is all those things. But that's really what this guy was about. There was one incident where he was crossing the George Washington Bridge, coming from Manhattan, going to New Jersey, and there was a hitchhiker there. And they locked eyes, and the hitchhiker had his thumb out. Richard passed him. And he raised his finger, and he gave him the finger. And Richard
the bird.
Went around,
gave,
all
gave
the way
the
back.
Yeah.
The guy was still standing there. Richard's looking in the mirror, lowering his window, looking in the mirror, lowering the window. He saw the moment. He picked up his pistol, boom, shot the guy in the chest and killed him.
And kept going.
Giving him the finger.
And kept driving.
Right. So be careful, you people out there. Be careful about who you give the finger to.
Well, I was going to say, what can people do to protect themselves? You know, I'm a proponent of the Second Amendment. I believe in concealed carry.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you want to get into a gun battle with an Iceman type. He's a pro. However, what do people do when something like this happens? I mean, are you screwed? I mean, if a serial killer wants you as his mark, is that history for you?
Well, you know, it's like, it's an interesting question. And what do we do when we travel these days? What do we do about terrorists? Can we get on a plane and safely? Is there some kind of mechanism in place where they store the luggage that'll go off when we get to a certain height? And if there's not, won't that be in the future for us for travel? Getting back to your question, it's the same type of thing. You really don't know. All you can do is not turn away from the truth. What you can do is acknowledge what's going on out there realistically and gear your life towards that. Lock your door, be aware of people following you home. Richard Ramirez, a lot of his victims, he followed them off from the freeway. He'd spot them on the freeway, they got off at an exit, and he'd be behind them. And they're thinking of their day, they're thinking about the tomorrow, or maybe a dinner, a party planned. And they have no idea that they're being stalked, or being somebody's following them, but they should. In three of the instances in the Night Stalker case, he walked right in the front door. The front door was open. It wasn't even locked. That's not a good thing, not in this day and age. And, you know, it's like the same. Our parents always said, watch out for strangers. Be careful with strangers. That's, like, really good advice. Watch out for strangers. And until people prove they could be trusted, they shouldn't be trusted, especially with our children. You have to really, really be suspect of everybody. And it's a sad commentary on our society. But it's the truth. We'd rather err on the side of the children than on the side of the predator.
Wildcard line, it's your turn. You're on with Philip. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, George. Real quick, 1975, you mentioned that year. You remember 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford?
And, yes.
And you remember the hitman Max von Sydow? I never thought that I would look at him like a father figure because the way he came across as a hitman. I used to think they were despicable until I saw that movie, and I thought, there's a reason for a hitman in this society. But anyway, my question was, there's an old saying that a secret is no longer a secret if more than one person knows about it. And I wanted to ask you, Philip, is there a world out there where a hitman would be hired to knock off the original hitman to silence the original assassin?
Yes, you know, it's amazing observations you're making so quickly. But yes, and in fact, I know one. Richard Kuklinski ran into a guy, Robert Prange, his name was, a Vietnam veteran who was a killer, who was a hired assassin. They were suddenly in an elevator in the hotel together. They were looking at each other, and they ran into each other again, and then they ran into each other a third time in the bathroom. And Richard was ready to pull a gun on the guy. He said to the guy, "Are you following me? Do you have business with me?" And the guy says, "No. Are you following me? Do you have business?" "No, you don't." He said, "But I'm doing a piece of work. But you have nothing to do with it." Well, he said, "Well, so am I. I'm doing a piece of work. You have nothing to do with it." And they parted like that. And then 2 days later, Richard's sitting in the car, still planning this murder. He had a special van that he had outfitted with a little bathroom, soda and things to drink, a radio. And he's sitting there waiting to kill this man. And along comes a Mrs. Sophie truck. So Richard thinks he'll get himself an ice cream. He gets out of the car. He flags the truck down. And it's this guy. He's Mr. Sophie. He says, "You got to be kidding." He says, "No, this is what I do." He said, "What do you mean this is what you do?" He said, "This is how I get around. This is my disguise."
It's his M.O., huh?
He said, "I love it. It's brilliant." They ended up going for a drink. They became friends. Prange took Richard to his secret garage. We had all these killing weapons. And it was Prange that first turned Richard on to using cyanide as a spray. In fact, he showed him. He made it right in front of him. There was a stray cat by some garbage cans. He said, "Watch this. Now, whatever you do, be careful about the wind." And he gave him this whole bunch of
stuff. Oh, God. And they're all animal abusers, Philip. But when we come back, tell me if Iceman killed the other contract killer. We'll be back. Well, we'll be live at the OnStar Studios in our city of Detroit, Motown, where I was born. So that'll be tomorrow. I'll be getting on a plane. It's going to be a quick night. Also gives you an opportunity to see my parents getting up there in age. So it's a twofer, I guess. So I'll be back with you in just a moment. We'll finish up with final phone calls with Philip Carlo, and then we shall teleport me to Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Philip, thanks for sticking around for nearly 4 hours. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, George.
Goes by quickly, though, doesn't it?
Unbelievably.
Yep. Back to final phone calls. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, Oh, hi. This is Ed calling from Buffalo, Minnesota.
Hey, Ed. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, George. And, Philip, I did read your book, and it scared the heck out of me, and I don't think I ever want to change a flat tire by myself again.
Right.
But anyway, I was wondering, the Gemini Lounge, who owned that back then? Is it still open, or they closed it down, or is it under a different name? Or?
Well, actually, it's under a different name now. Roy DeMeo owned it back then. It was his place. For your listeners' benefit, George, the Gemini Lounge was owned by a Gambino captain named Roy DeMeo, who did a lot of work with Richard, and their specialty was killing people, and they killed a lot of people, cut them up, and got rid of them in the Great Jamaica Bay and in landfills in that section of Canarsie, Brooklyn. Very, very scary guy, and Richard Kuklinski killed him.
There you go. Okay, thanks for the call. In most of the mob killings, they were all internal, weren't they?
What do you mean, George, internal?
Well, you know, it was mobster against mobster, position.
Well, pretty much, absolutely. Often, though, if civilians, a mob guy, like I said earlier, there was a case where a man that worked for a hotel down in Florida raped the niece of a mob guy and got away with it because the rape happened from behind. This is what this guy did. He came up behind women. They never saw him. But he was ultimately put in the lineup, but she couldn't ID the guy. He got away with it. Richard was hired to go down there and get him. And he abducted him from a parking lot one night, took him to a secluded area on the beach, and proceeded to torture him terribly. He ripped off all his clothes. He grabbed his testicles and his penis, and he jerked it off. He didn't cut it off. He pulled it off. He held it up to him in front of the guy, and he said, "This is what got you in all the problem. You don't need it." Threw him on the ground, and then he proceeded to slice skirt steaks from him. And when a lot of raw meat was exposed, he casually went back to his van. He had a box of kosher salt, fine kosher salt, covered the guy with the salt, and the guy's is in pain beyond what we can imagine.
Well, I would think so.
Well, and then Richard cut him loose, put a life preserver on him, took him down to the water and threw him in the water where he knew there would be sharks. And in fact, he studied it. He knew at the high tide at this particular beach, tiger sharks prowled the shallows. And sure enough, with all that flesh and blood that came up, and he watched the guy being pulled under, and he considered he did a job well done. And this is the type of murder he committed outside of the spectrum of.
How much money did he make, Philip? Did he ever tell you?
I think he made a lot of money. I think ultimately the going rate was anywhere from, let's say, $20,000 to $125,000. But he had a gambling problem. He was a degenerate gambler. He'd sometimes go to Las Vegas, and he'd squander a lot of money. So he never really became a wealthy man, as he could have, if he had been investing in real estate and stocks and bonds. He just didn't have that in him. And he was, like I said, he was a chronic gambler.
And I'm sure they paid him in what? Satchels of cash?
Oh, yeah. Cash money. I mean, you know, there's no checks in that business.
No, I guess not. Here's a check for murder, you know?
Yeah.
No. First time caller line. You're up with us. Hi there. Hello? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. My name's Sarah. I'm calling from Chicago.
Hey, Sarah.
Hello. I'm Philip, and an honor to talk to you, Mr. Norrie.
Thank you.
I'm calling. I have a question, and I'm just wondering if you could maybe explain the person, the kind of person who would be a pathological liar. And I'm calling in regards to the Scott Peterson case.
Yeah, you mean your boyfriend?
My husband.
Yeah.
After that case.
I was close. It's hard to say. You know, some people being a pathological liar is very good in an occupation. Car salesmen, people selling stocks and bonds, insurance people. Well, it comes in handy. But when people you love lie to you in that way, it's hurtful and painful. And you know, what is what you're asking, how they become a pathological liar, or how
they trick you,
and how dangerous can it be?
Say again.
I know how dangerous. I just remember with the case with Amber Fry, his girlfriend.
Right.
Her attorney has said, you know, with his secret life, how much he lied. He can lie to anybody into their face.
Right. Well, you're talking about Peterson.
My husband, I know, he said two things to me that I can only believe. And one is that he lies as easily as he can breathe. And the second is that he'll do anything for money.
And you're still married?
Yeah.
Where is he right now? Listening in?
No, he's sleeping.
He's sleeping. Oh, my goodness.
Taking a chance here. All right, go ahead.
Well, I suggest you get on Match.com immediately and find yourself a new man. No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Hey, I'm sure you're...
Fill up.
But you know, when you're involved with somebody that is a pathological liar and is causing pain, I think any therapist would say to you, you try therapy with that person. If that doesn't work, get out of the relationship. Or maybe you can live with it. Maybe you can. I don't know. I mean, I don't know you. I don't know your circumstances. I don't really even know what the question is, to tell you the truth.
Was the Iceman a liar?
Yes, a pathological liar.
He was, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was very, very glib. He could make you believe that it was raining when it was nice outside. But that has to do exactly with what we were talking about before, about all these killers being able to take on the guys that they wanted to portray. And not only do it, but doing it eminently believable, like Ted Bundy with the cast on his arm, like John Wayne Gacy in Chicago, where this woman comes from, who dressed up as clown. And, you know, he had everybody in the community believe he was a great guy. And
well,
it was okay to go.
I hate clowns. I would have spotted the guy.
It's funny you say that, because apparently a lot of these types of individuals do take on the guise of a clown, thinking that under that they can go certain places and have a certain type of freedom that they perhaps wouldn't normally have. But the point is that they are all able to do that, including the terrorists. They can convince people that are the security for a plane that it's okay to let them on the plane. Remember Otter? Well, he did it. And so that's another interesting aspect of who these people are.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hey.
This is Jason. I'm calling from Pineville, Oregon.
Hi, okay, Jason.
And I had a question and also something I wanted to tell you.
Yes.
I don't exactly know. I can't remember if they still have it, but did you know that Oregon has the only law that you can perform assisted suicide?
To tell you the truth, no. Off the top of my head, I didn't know that.
Of course, Jack Kevorkian knew that, I think.
Yeah, but I think it's a good thing.
That in turn was my question. I was wondering if you thought that Kevorkian was just a guy trying to help somebody, or if that was just a way to for him just to kill people.
Right. Very, very interesting question, and I have strong feelings about it. I think what he was doing initially might have been for the better good of people. But it just seemed that he was doing it with such an obsession, and he wouldn't stop when he was told to stop, and rightfully told to stop. And he always had this smirk, this bemused, I have a secret that you don't know look. And I really think that this guy might very well be a serial killer and just really getting off on being able to kill people and doing it under the guise of he's doing it for them and not for himself. I have very mixed feelings about this guy. I wouldn't leave him alone with my children. If I had children, I don't. But I don't trust him. I don't like him. There's something about him that gives me the creeps.
You know, maybe the power went to his head, too.
That, too.
West of the Rockies, your turn. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
We are well, thanks.
Well, good. I hope I have a wife when I come back to bed. I'm a stay-at-home dad, and I have a question about sex offenders.
Right.
Here's the deal. Last year, I took my son to school in the first grade,
right.
And I was talking to some moms, and they're going, well, you hear about the sex offender lives across the street? And I'm going, no, you got to be kidding. What? And here comes this dad who doesn't drop his daughter off all the time. Well, yeah, he does. I lied. He does. And he says, Well, you know why I drop my daughter off every day from school? And she says, no, why? Well, because the sex center lives right across the street. And I'm going like, you got to be kidding.
Right.
The sex center right across the street? Yeah, level one. Yeah, you know, that you need to watch your... And I said, I walk my son every day to school.
Right.
And so all the moms are talking. And so the guy says, look, I'll come back tomorrow with a picture of him. I'll go online and get a picture of him. So I started... He goes, I bet if you take this picture and you go up and down the street to all the women here, they won't know. And so I did that. And some knew and some didn't. And so then one lady said, you better watch what you're doing. You're going to get in trouble. So I called my attorney. The attorney says, you have every right to do what you're going to do. Got a hold of the detective that charges all the sex offenders in the area. And he says, yeah, the guy's trouble. Yeah, I heard the guy is handicapped, and he hasn't done anything for 14 years. And the officer said, well, yeah, and then I heard he's been on the campus 3 times. He went the other day looking for food. I asked the principal. The principal said, yeah, he's harmless. He's handicapped. Mm-hmm. And the detective said, yeah, he is harmless, but we still got to watch him. We can't do anything with him because if he gets on campus, we arrest him, then we have to let him go again. And so I was going to call the newspaper. I was going to call the TV stations. And then my wife said, you better be a good girl, boy, and you better go talk to the principal.
Sure.
And I said, okay. So I put my guns in the holster, and I went and talked to the principal. And she said, you know what? It's, the best thing you need to do is just sit in your car and be quiet because, we wouldn't want to drag your son through this now. And I go, what's that supposed to mean? So then I found out later that if you're a troubled parent, that your son will get a little bullet next to his card, and he'll have a he'll be known that he has a parent that makes waves.
Oh, you're kidding me.
So no, I'm serious. So jeez. So the summer went by. And I thought, okay, my hands are tied. So then just 2 days ago, I dropped my son off, or I went to pick my son up, and one of the parents go, well, this guy's out again. Looking at the school, you better watch him.
Sure.
You go down by the corner and watch. I said, you bet. I'll pick my son up, and I'll go and watch what he's doing. Well, I went down there, and he was gone.
Uh-huh.
So before, I forgot something real quick. When I was showing the parents the picture of this guy, I was going to show them the picture and I lost it. I said, let's go in the school. They have it right in there.
Sure.
And I sent the 3 parents in there and the people in the school ripped it down. And they said, if you want to know what he looks like, you go online. Here's his name.
Right.
We're not going to show you the picture.
Hmm.
And so I was trying to find out, obviously there's politics between the city. There's politics between the school and there's politics between the parent issue. I'm just,
right. I have some suggestions if I may. First off, don't be concerned about what whatever you feel you should do in order to protect your son, you should do. Take out the guns. The fact that the individual is handicapped can be just a ruse to make people think that he's harmless. You can't buy that at first face value. Number two, he shouldn't be living near a school. Unto itself is wrong, and it's usually against the law. They have to live a certain space between school, any place where children congregate, and I wouldn't be at all hesitant or reticent about going to the police and telling them and sharing your feelings with them and hearing what their thoughts are. And going to the principal and telling him too. And don't be concerned what anyone thinks about what you do, as long as you do it in a mature,
correct,
intelligent way, and don't be start yelling and screaming at people and stuff like
have
that.
Have you ever confronted this guy, Bruce?
No, I haven't. Never seen him. The one attorney says, these guys have rights. They got to be careful what you got to do.
Now, when you say he lives across the street, what is across the street?
Well, there's a school and then there's a playground, and he lives right across the playground. But you can.
Is he in a house or what?
In a house.
By the way, does he live by himself?
No, he lives with his mother, I think, a grandmother. I'm not sure on that.
They're not supposed to be living near playgrounds either, and that might very well be a good basis to get him removed. But like we've been saying all night, it's always better to err on the side of the child. Once somebody crosses that bridge, once they do that, they're pariah, and that's how they have to be treated. I have no problem with putting a letter on their forehead, pedophile. I feel that strongly about the destruction these people do. The average pedophile abuses 67 children before they become in contact with law enforcement. And I can only imagine what this guy did in order for him to be an ID sex offender. Do you know whether or not he's a pedophile or perhaps he raped a grown woman?
He's gone.
Yeah, okay.
So we don't know what he did.
Interesting setup.
east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. How are you, gentlemen, tonight?
We're fine, sir. Go ahead.
Good. My question to Philip is, yes. I've read the book by Don Franco, and I'm sure you're familiar with that, taking the credit for the Hoffa killing.
Yes. By paint houses, you mean?
Pardon me?
Painted houses?
No. If you can hold just a second, I can get the book. It's by...
Well, we've only got 2 minutes left.
Okay,
so,
the two authors that wrote it, one has since passed away, and one I think his name's Headley.
Uh-huh.
Don Franco.
Uh-huh.
He was never a made man because he was, you know, not a completely Italian or Sicilian.
Right.
But he took the credit for the Hoffa killing.
Well, a whole bunch, there's a lineup of people that have taken credit for that killing. And all I can say is, until there's definitive proof, more than taking credit, I look at them all with a jointed eye. Mm-hmm. Every year, the FBI comes up with a new hot. We got Hoffa's body. We got Hoffa's body, and they call the news media, and they keep coming up with blanks.
Remember when they dug up that farm in Michigan?
The farm, and they found chicken bones. But why did we call the press conference there? That was like when Geraldo Rivera opened the Al Capone safe. I mean, why have the media there unless you know you're going to find something? I'm kind of scratching my head about that whole scenario. But suffice it to say, there are several people who definitively say they killed Mr. Hoffa. And I think Richard is one of four or five. And like I said several times this evening, what he told me sounded eminently believable. He never told me about the incident until I basically badgered him to tell me about it. I do believe the story that he told me. And until I see video or hear audio to indicate otherwise, I believe that Richard was involved in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa.
Well, you know what? With so many killings, he probably was involved in many, many more, Philip, huh?
Exactly right, George.
And he took him to the grave, I guess, didn't he?
I think he did, George.
Okay. And the family still around?
Yes, they are. I'm in contact with the wife, in contact with the daughters.
Hey, you know what? It'd be an interesting segment if you ever wanted to get them on the program
absolutely.
For even just a half hour.
Yeah, what a great idea.
Let's do that.
I'll speak to your people, as it were, and I'll get them on.
Go for it, Philip.
The daughter, Merrick. And
okay, we got to run, Philip. We're out of time.
A lot to say.
All right, thanks. Philip Carlo, great book, The Iceman, for Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition out of Detroit. Until then, be safe, everyone.